This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Justice Stephen Breyer is the 108th person to sit on the Supreme Court. Soon, he will welcome the 114th as President Trump nominates a successor to Justice Anthony Kennedy. We interviewed His Honor before an invited audience at the Aspen Institute. NPR's Nina Totenberg was following developments over the weekend inside the Trump camp, and one source summed things up as chaotic. But Justice Breyer doesn't do chaos. President Clinton appointed him in 1994. These days, he finds himself much more in the dissent than in the majority. But three words guide his approach to the law: pragmatic, undogmatic, and adaptive. That's where our conversation began. Because whatever your politics, there seems to be very little that's pragmatic or undogmatic or adaptive about society right now. And if the future of the Supreme Court has you freaked out, Justice Breyer urges you to calm down and take the long view.
Let's go back, and I'll ask at least rhetorically, in the 1830s or 1840s, when there was a legal question about the federal government, it was Georgia. They found gold. The land that they found it on belonged to the Cherokees, and so they took it. Because after all, they thought, why should the Indians have this gold? Why shouldn't we? We are Georgians, and they are not. And law cases were brought. And the Indians naturally won. They were totally right. And the President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, said, John Marshall, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, has made his decision. Now let him enforce it. And he sent troops, but not to enforce the decision, but rather to drive out the Indians to Oklahoma, where they live in this day. So was that a period that was, what were the words?
Pragmatic, undogmatic, and adaptive.
Undogmatic and adaptive? Well, maybe in a sense, but not in a very good sense. Or let's go through the Civil War days. Or let's go through Reconstruction. Or let's go through 80 years of legal segregation. And do you think those were days that were what? Pragmatic, adaptive? Well, if they were adaptive, I didn't see it. And the amazing thing about it, I think, is what Tocqueville said in about 1840 when he came over here, and he said the first thing he notices was the clamor. What did he mean by that? He said what he meant. He meant the clamor of every group under the sun trying to work out their differences, and maybe they should have been more polite about it, but they had institutions that helped them work things out. And our job on the Supreme Court then, and I think it's just as now, when it's best, it comes in last. Because I hate to tell you, we are not great experts on all these different subjects. But we can look at what other people have decided to do about such matters as privacy and the internet. And that's probably better than using armed weapons.
I would imagine it's a lot better than using armed weapons.
Well, I say that to students at Stanford, and you want a tough one. I get this question. What about Bush v. Gore? And I have my Stanford audience. I know what they're thinking. I say, I know right now when I say that, that at least 20% of you are thinking too bad there weren't a few guns or stones or something. And I say, I know that's what you're thinking. So turn on the television set. And see what happens in countries that decide their big problems and differences that way. So I don't think it's so bad to have an institution that will, in fact, say, Mr. Legislator, President, or whoever, does your solution comport with this basic document? Even if I disagree with the results, and I do not disagree with every result. That's a false rumor. I disagree with some results,
right,
as does everyone.
Right. When you do write a dissent, how do you view your role as a dissenter on the court? What's the value to you for posterity of being someone who says, yeah, that's what the majority thinks, but I think they're wrong, and here's why?
That is a very, very good question. And there are different kinds of dissents. And the best kind of dissent is you're writing a dissent to try to convince someone who, it's tentatively, because it's always tentative until the last minute, on the other side. And you're saying, you see it this way. See it this way. That's why. And nobody who writes an opinion likes to look like an idiot. So if you have a good argument there, they'll change it. And that's always up for grabs. And so the best kind of dissent is where you feel you're doing that, you're going to point something out, and you have a hope here of at least a major change for the future, even if they don't join you. Or you could say, let this one pass. And if you look back to the period with Holmes, early part of the 20th century, that happened a lot. 19th century happened a lot. People said, let it pass. Congress can change it. I can't do anything, really. I won't write a dissent.
So kind of the legal philosophy around dissent has changed.
You could. I think it has. I think there are more of them. The more 5-4s, the more dissents.
Does that mean that you, since you mentioned 5-4s, does the court try not to end up with 5-4s? Like, is there an effort to try to have more?
Yeah, I think there
7-2, 8-1 decisions?
I think there is. Now, you can say, how much? Shouldn't it be more? And if you're in the 4, you certainly think it should be more. You think, well, why is it so important to try to get more together? Think of what Earl Warren did to try to get 9 people on that opinion, Brown versus Board of Education, ending segregation. He thought that was pretty important. And think of what happened after that. 1954, the opinion came down. And do you know what happened in 1955? Yeah, nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. That's right, nothing. And 1956? Yeah.
Every state fought like hell.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And I remember impeach Earl Warren signs all over the South. You better learn how a judge said, yes, now's the time, and integrate that central high school. And Governor Faubus got out in front of the school with the White Citizens Council and said, no. He said, the judge has an order, but I have the state police. And we remember, I remember, and they should see it, Elizabeth Eckford reading that book. Black girl trying to go into the white school, turned away, and she's reading like this with her books, and the girl behind her, her face contorted with anger at the thought of a black child going into this school. And to end that, Eisenhower had to send 1,000 paratroopers, which was not such an easy decision at that time, because he was told by Jimmy Burns, former Supreme Court Justice, resigned to run our war effort on the civilian side. Moderate on race, governor of South Carolina. He said, Mr. President, if you send troops to Little Rock, you better be prepared to occupy the entire South. You better be prepared for a second Reconstruction. But Herbert Brownell said to the president, send them. It's a question of the rule of law. Do it. And he did it.
Since you brought up the relationship between the court and the public in Brown v. Board, I wonder if we could come forward to the relationship today, sort of by way of talking about Justice Kennedy and the nomination that'll be announced on Monday. I wonder how you see the public's relationship with the Supreme Court. It seems like many people who are the most passionate about whoever this nominee is going to be, and I don't want you to stray into territory you can't discuss regarding the nominee or the process, but it feels like a lot of people have a real dog in this fight. They want something from the Supreme Court, and they want someone who's going to give it to them. But that's not really the court's job. The court's job is to kind of wrestle with whatever legal questions come before it in a thoughtful and a fair manner, but try telling that to people who are fired up about Roe v. Wade, or Hobby Lobby, or Obamacare, or same-sex marriage, or, you know, the travel ban. How do you see the public's relationship with the Supreme Court today? Do people really get what your job is?
Oh, yeah, I wish Sandra O'Connor were here. And I really do. I loved her. And I did. And I think what she would say, and Tony, too, Tony Kennedy, and me, and probably everybody, is that the most significant thing we can do is to encourage, we were talking about this at lunch, people to teach civics in the high schools, because they have to know what we do.
Can I ask you about something that's one of these, let me shift gears a little bit to one of these recent legal controversies that I think a lot of people have been following quite a bit as it relates to the relationship between the public and the Supreme Court. There have been a number of recent decisions that have been written in a fairly narrowly tailored way, dealing with some big issues, the gerrymandering decisions in Wisconsin and Maryland, for example. And in those cases, a lot of people really wanted the court to definitively answer the question of whether designing political districts to advantage one party over another is constitutional or not. And the court hasn't answered that. And I guess I understand why, but that's the question that we were dying to know. We don't really care about Maryland or Wisconsin as much as we care about this larger legal question. I think I speak for a lot of Americans when I ask you in that regard, what were you waiting for? Why not just answer the question if you know that's what we need?
There are a lot of cases where people see the law and they understand how you might deal with it in this situation. If you go back to a case in your subject called Veith, you will see that four of us thought that there were standards to govern such things, which is the problem. It's worth having these nine unelected people or more unelected people sometimes say things that you think are important, absolutely wrong, and yet that's their view of it, and then you do it. Oh, dear. But until you get them convinced that it's worth having an institution like that, it's called the rule of law, you won't have it.
We're speaking to Justice Stephen Breyer. Our conversation was recorded over this past weekend in Aspen, Colorado. Still to come, we'll talk more about dissent, we'll get some questions from the audience in Aspen, and we'll hear what plans, if any, Breyer has to retire.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're talking about the state of the Supreme Court with Justice Stephen Breyer. We'll pick up our conversation from this weekend with some thoughts about the changing makeup of the court and what direction it might be headed in.
I wonder where you see this intersection of civil rights, civil liberties, First Amendment protections, minority rights as the court deals with it and thinks through it. Where's that going?
We don't think generally. I mean, we don't. Oh, I shouldn't say that. That's really bad.
Take that again.
I better not say it that way.
No.
I mean, in general, that's like, you know, David Souter and I were always getting, people would call me Souter, and they'd call him Breyer sometimes, all right. And I don't know why, maybe because we were both, came to the court from New England, whatever it is. You don't plan out a general direction. That's really not the job. Now, of course, if I've written, for example, a long dissent, on the question of whether certain immigrants should be given bail. Now, the court didn't decide that. So if that comes back, I'll probably start anyway with what I've already written. And so naturally, in that respect, a particular case about a particular thing, you have a direction. But in general, the job is, and this is where I started, you take the case. That's why I started with this stuff. Law is a very big, complicated business around a long time with institutions, lots of cases, lots of different human needs, sometimes in conflict, sometimes reflected in the institutions, sometimes requiring some change, sometimes not. It's messy, and you're tinkering at the edges almost all the time.
I wonder what you would like the American people to keep in mind about the Supreme Court as we think about its future. Of course, there are certain issues that people want the court to rule on, questions we want the court to answer, ways we want the court to answer those questions. What do you want us as the American people to keep in mind about the court, the seat, the process, as we wait for this nominee?
One thing is that this document, it lays out some frontiers, some of them pretty important frontiers, free speech and so forth. Within those frontiers, which are broad, people make up their own minds. And that's why you don't like what's going on, you go to the ballot box. I'm afraid that's for almost everything. I'd also like, secondarily, people to realize that it is a long deliberative process. When I first went to the court, I'd run into differences among people, but I never saw differences until I got to Washington. There were really differences. Okay, and first I thought, why doesn't everybody agree with me who am so wonderfully reasonable? And then after a time, I thought, no, it's a big country. There are, in fact, 320 million people. My mother used to say, and every one of them holds some different opinion, there's no opinion so odd that there isn't somebody who doesn't hold it. And she used to say they all live in Los Angeles. That's because we live in San Francisco. Or, but nonetheless, forget that inter-rivalry. But nonetheless, we have a system here that does not work perfectly, but it is a system where long-term you are trying to get something to work, which is this messy, complicated, multi-institutional body called law. And we're not always going to agree. But when people ask me, what am I going to do over the next few years? I say, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do my job. That's what my father would have told me. He would have said, do your job. And we're all good friends. There is no personal hostility.
Among the justices?
None. No. There just isn't. And you can be as opposite ends as can be on an issue, and when you're up there at lunch, fine. You are back, and there is civility, and I've never heard a voice raised in anger in that conference room. I have never heard one person made some kind of a crack or slighting remark about the other. It's professional. You go around the table, you discuss it on the merits, and you try to do your job.
It never got heated?
Never. Well, heated. Oh, wait. Heated.
Or yeah. Uncivil, I should say. It never got uncivil?
Oh, heated. If I feel heated, and I might in some case, the thing for me to do is to sit there like this, and in the evening, I tell Joanna, I felt heated.
You clearly handle your heat better than a lot of people, I think. That you can do it with that kind of a Vulcan aplomb. I think I'm upset now. Let's get to a few audience questions. Yes.
Ron Rubenstein from Piedmont, California, sort of your home base. I want just a basic question. How did you feel about the Senate not entertaining the nomination of Justice Garland for a Supreme Court position?
How I felt, I think I will say this, that I was not in the position of nominating anyone. I was nominated. I was not in the position of confirming anyone. I was confirmed. So to ask me about the process of nomination and confirmation is like asking for the recipe of chicken a la king from the point of view of the chicken.
Well,
yes. No, I know.
Well, hold on a second.
That was just a way. That was a way of avoiding answering the question.
Well, yeah, but hold on a second, because I see where he's coming from. I mean, you may be the chicken, but you're also an American citizen, and there is something to be said about the necessity of the Senate to advise and consent on nominations to the Supreme Court, and that is an extant debate right now, whether we should wait until after the midterms, whether we should go ahead and confirm a new justice now. You've got to have a feeling on this as an American. You are a justice, yes, but you have to feel something about this. I mean, don't you? Or are you really that just emotionally removed from it?
Not everything that is thought has to be said. Not everything that is said. Who said that? Somebody at Yale. It was very good, actually. It's so true. Not everything that's thought has to be said. Not everything that is said has to be written. And not everything that is written has to be published. Which we're sorry about if they didn't.
Well,
right?
Yes.
Hi, my name's Ted Frisbee. I teach at down in Carbondale. Piggybacking on what you said about dissent, Justice Breyer, it's my understanding that you and Justice Kagan wrote a separate dissent from Justice Sotomayor and Bader Ginsburg in the recent decision about the immigration ban. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what motivated you to do that, and if that's standard to have multiple dissents written or not.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And that's such a sense, I don't normally do this, and that is special. I mean, normally what I'm about to say. But that's such a special case, and it's such a special time that the only thing I can do about that particular question you ask, which I've been unfair to all your questions, but for the same reason, because I think I just better be safe rather than sorry. So I can recommend you to read the two, and you will see if you read the two where they are similar and where they are different.
Yes.
There's discussion today that Roe v. Wade may be overruled because that decision does not fit the text and language of the Constitution or the original intent of the Constitution. And assuming that to be true for this question, if Roe versus Wade is reversed, doesn't that call into question the Supreme Court decisions stating that a corporation is a person and that a corporation has religious rights, because those two issues are not found in the text or language of the Constitution or in the original intent of the Constitution?
Yeah, because you want, see, this is the problem. I've managed so far to stay away from it, and I think I still stay away from it. And if you want, and very interesting, if you're really interested in some of the things which you put in a minor part of this, but a very interesting book I read recently, if I can have a commercial, is I read a book by a professor at UCLA, whom I know, called Adam Winkler, on the history of corporations being a person. And if you get interested in that subject, which I'm not sure you are, but if you are, read it. It's a good book. I know it's not satisfactory if I don't answer things like that, but I just feel I can't.
Hi, I'm Courtney Stewart Albon. I'm a lawyer, and I live in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I appreciated your point that the Supreme Court doesn't think generally, or justices don't think generally, but don't deal in generalities. I'm wondering, though, if you can then speak to how, if in ways in which you feel you specifically have changed in your tenure on the bench.
I think that every judge, when he approaches a problem of text, will read the text. And it always makes a difference. It limits what you can't say, at the least. The history of it. They'll look at tradition. They'll look at precedent. They will look at the purpose of this. Somebody had some reason for writing this. And in the Constitution, there's some value that underlies this. A particular value of the First Amendment is not the same as the Fourth Amendment. And they'll look at consequences. So the language, the history, the tradition, the precedent, the purposes or values and the consequences, all judges look at those, and some emphasize more the first four. You know, the precedent and the language and the history and tradition, and some, probably I'm in that group, will emphasize more the purposes and the consequences. And in the constitutional area, he will look more to the history of the Constitution. What would people have thought in 1789? And I probably look less at that and look more at what I think is the underlying value, which changes, not the value, but how it's applied changes over time. Now, I would say over time, probably because I probably pay more attention to, I don't give up my basic points of view, but I want to be sure I have the precedents right. I want to be sure I have not gone too far with this language. If the language says that something about a carrot, that is not an iceberg, you know? I mean, just things you can't do. When you first get there, those first two or three years, you will decide things, and you will make footprints. And you will discover in later years that those footprints tend to guide you. Because suppose they didn't, then you just decide anything you want. That would be terrible. Because then the public, the American people, would have lost control. Reason through the complex sets of things I listed at the outset. But reason and consistency is the key, I think, to virtue in judging.
Justice, you were asked a question about a Kennedy. I'm going to ask you about an unrelated Kennedy. So before you became a Supreme Court Justice, you worked for Senator Kennedy. What was the thing that you learned working for Senator Kennedy which has most guided you in your practice on the court?
Don't go for the credit. Don't go for the credit. Credit is a weapon. You use it. And you use that weapon in order to get something done. And if you have a choice between being the hero of the hour with lots of credit or getting something done, and it's only 20% of what you want, go for the 20%. The best is the enemy of the good. over and over. And I cannot tell you how many times I saw him put that into practice. We'd be trying to get something. There'd be a senator, maybe from the other party, and he'd be talking, what a good idea you have. Because eventually you'd say something, even with the other party, et cetera, that we agree with. What a good idea. Let's work with that. And we work with that and try and get something done. And if it gets done, who is it he pushes out in front at the press conference? You. What a help you were. And the object is to get the thing done. The object is not really to get the credit. And working with him on, God, it was a pleasure. And he had a sense of humor, as I say. It was just fun.
I know we have to adjourn in just a second, and I hear the elements are not on our side. So I want to get one last question in before we have to let you go. And it, of course, as we're thinking about the transition of the court, we'll have a new Supreme Court justice in due course. I wonder how you are contemplating your future on the court, whether or not you have thought about how you're contemplating your own future as an associate justice. Is there a point at which you will start to get ready to step down?
Yes, there is such a point.
And how, pray tell, are you thinking about what that point might look like?
No.
Oh, come on. No. No. Ah, no. See, here's, I think it's easy for you to say no, but there are a lot of Americans right now who are deeply, deeply concerned about the direction of the country. And the Supreme Court is something we have no power over. We can't touch that. And so I think it means a lot to people who look to you as an exemplar of the law to know that you are there or to know that you are leaving, to give them confidence in what's going on with the courts. We don't have any power over the Supreme Court. So for those Americans who look at the court as this vast, immane, untouchable structure, and you within it, and wondering, well, what's that like? Who is he in there? What would you say to them about your future on the court?
I'd say that I'll do my job as long as I think I can do it properly. And under the human, I got a question in this form. You were much more polite. The person was really hedging around, and I said, but you say, how will I know when I go gaga? That's what you really want to know. And I said, well, there's a case of, which was it? I think it was Holmes or somebody had to go off and see, was it Field, and say, Mr. Justice, I think the other members of the court feel you've done a wonderful job here. It may be time to think about stepping down. And then I think Brandeis said, or somebody said he had to see Holmes, said, you remember the day when you went off and saw Justice, whatever it was, and told him that about time maybe he'd stepped down, he'd done a great job. And Holmes said, yeah. He said, I do remember, and a dirtier day's work I've never done, he said. But I mean, I think, so what happens if we all go gaga at once? We won't. And so it will become apparent, I think, to me, that as it does to people as they get older, that this seems to be about the right time. And there we are. And that's the most I can say.
Well, we're grateful to have had you for this time. Thanks for talking to us. Ladies and gentlemen, Justice Stephen Breyer.
Thank you,
sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks to Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer and to the Aspen Institute for their help this weekend. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.